The In-Between is intended for mature audiences and may include topics that can be unsettling, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, rape, murder, and animal abuse. Testimony shared by guests of the show is their own and does not reflect the views of Mel Barrett, Ruby Grace Productions, or Grab Bag Collab. Listener discretion is advised.
Can we admit that we're all transfixed by that sick little soap opera trial in Exeter, New Hampshire?
What time did you get here today?
1:30 this morning.
1:30? Why?
Wanted to get a front row seat, I guess.
If this story were a made-for-TV movie, and it surely will be, you might not believe it.
It is August 1st, 1990. Time is 10 a.m. Seabrook, New Hampshire. We're about to do a one-party consent via telephone.
Sat around brainstorming the pros and cons of slitting a man's throat rather than firing a 38 caliber projectile through his head.
Yes.
There's only one person in the state of New York who is sitting in prison tonight with a sentence of life with absolutely no possibility of parole.
Yes, I need a policeman. 4D Misty Morning Drive.
Okay, what's going on over there, ma'am?
There's somebody screaming for help outside.
Hi, welcome back to the In-Between Podcast. I'm your host, Mel Barrett. I record conversations for a living. I do this so that I can tell you these stories factually and to give you a window into the emotions of the person I'm speaking with. It feels weird sometimes, a lot of the time, actually. And when I'm recording, I definitely have an agenda. My agenda is finding out the truth of this story about Greg Smart's murder, for instance. So my questions and responses are pushing that little car that is my brain uphill. I do not manipulate facts, though I do sometimes give my opinion. I also may lay out information that I'm tracking down with the absolute certainty that if and when I find the answers to my questions, I'll report that to you, dear listeners. I can only report out what I have verified myself. So if you've given me information or posted information yourself and I can't verify it, I'm not going to report it here. I've had access to Pamela Smart for many years, and now I have access to the entire case file, all of the police reports, the entire trial transcripts, including what happened in the judges' chambers and sidebars, and just last night, I gained access to the wiretaps and the transcripts that go along with them, which means I'm frantically rewriting and recutting this episode right now to get it to you on Wednesday as scheduled. As for the interviews I've conducted, I try to forget that I'm recording when I'm interviewing a subject so I'm not thinking of how I sound or to keep myself from acting for the audio. Recording ourselves and others is like air nowadays. Reels, TikTok, YouTube, the little camera at the ATM, the 7-Eleven cameras watching our every move, surveillance on our streets in most major cities. So much of our lives are recorded. Do you ever wonder why we choose not to record something? What keeps us from posting something personal on social media? Are we thinking of our own narrative? Thinking, how will this portray me to the world? I think about it all the time. I go through stages of not posting anything about my life, and then there are other times when I feel the need to connect. I'm posting every day. How about you? Do you share the truth, or is it a sanitized version of your reality for your audience? Early in my career, I was a reality television producer. In my opinion, we started recording ourselves and others because of reality TV. It became our vernacular. Pics, or it didn't happen. Video, or it didn't happen. Many years ago, I published a novel called Viral about a woman who finds relevance, not necessarily the kind she's looking for, in recording a heinous attack by powerful men on a coworker, which she then exposes to the world via YouTube. It's not a masterpiece or anything, and it went to press before some typos were caught, but it's out there, and it's my exploration of how we create our own realities. I've been obsessed for a long time with the idea that we have these loaded weapons / accountability machines in our pockets at all times. Imagine if Cecilia Pierce, or Pamela Smart for that matter, had a smartphone in their pocket. The audio would definitely have been better. Then again, imagine if the jury had been told the whole story. Mind blown. When the Pamela Smart wiretaps happened, then Rodney King, OJ's Bronco Chase, 9/11, VTech, the Pulse Massacre, Parkland, Charlottesville, and culminated with a reality show president, I found myself wondering if what I feared back then, that we weren't being told the truth and would need to tell it ourselves, had become a reality so far beyond my fears that there's no going back from it. Reality television and a lesser-known theory by journalist and writer David Zweig called fiction depersonalization syndrome is where I focus my thoughts and opinions about recording someone surreptitiously or not. I'll refer to the syndrome as FDPS going forward. Here's David Zweig explaining his theory. Quote, fiction depersonalization syndrome, a hypothesis that I have developed, posits that immersion in the Western world's highly mediated environment, most of which functions as a result of recent and continuing technological advances, leads to increased self-consciousness. The extreme endpoint of this phenomenon is depersonalization, a psychological disorder where one is literally watching oneself from afar, as if in a movie or a dream. Further, this hyper-self-consciousness may lead to isolation, though paradoxically, we are more technologically connected than ever. Today, we are living in an observational reality rather than the historically dominant experiential reality. For the first time in history, people are spending more hours of their day immersed in fiction, defined in this context as media, especially observable media, television, movies, the internet, social media, smartphones, ubiquitous advertising, even the news, rather than living in the moment, i.e. engaged directly with others or the environment. This is a fundamental change in how humans have lived for all of history. And living this highly mediated life, which for many of us means being immersed in fiction for the majority of our waking hours, inevitably alters the way one perceives oneself and reality itself. End quote. Many of us are walking through the world as if hidden reality show cameras are following our every move. Does that mean many of us are acting in our everyday lives, even to ourselves? Are you? Am I? Well, shit. I think more importantly, the question in this moment for the sake of this podcast is, was Pamela Smart, a woman who is serving life without the possibility of parole for accomplice to first-degree murder, acting when she was recorded by the Derry police and Cecilia Pierce? She says she was.
State your full name, please spell for the court reporter your last name.
Brian Washburn, W-S-H-B-U-R-N.
Can you tell the people in the jury what your relationship was with Greg Smart?
It's very strong. He was my best friend.
Did Pamela Smart tell you before July 13th anything about going to talk to Cecilia Pierce because she suspected her?
She didn't say she was going to. She had just indicated to me that she thought that maybe Cecilia and Rachel knew something about this.
What did she say she was going to do because of that?
What she said to me was, I wonder if I act like I know something about this, if they'll say something to me.
Did you respond to that?
Yeah.
What did you tell her?
I told her not to be an idiot, but I use a different word.
That's Brian Washburn, Greg Smart's best friend, testifying that Pam Smart told him days before the first recorded conversation with Cecilia Pierce that she might try to entrap Cecilia because she was the only one giving Pam information about the case. Meaning Cecilia knew more than Pam did. She certainly knew more than the cops did. And here's Pam interpreting Brian's response to her.
Don't be an asshole.
Here's where I get caught up on the wiretaps. The wiretaps were the only evidence besides witness testimony from three teenagers who had plea bargains with the state, and one other teenager who was involved in the plot but had no charges and allegedly no deal that convicted Pamela Smart. But Brian Washburn testified that Pam told him days before that she was going to trap Cecilia. According to the police reports, Brian's girlfriend Tracy also witnessed this conversation, but she was never called as a witness. And when the lawyers told her not to talk to Cecilia because she was wiretapped, what did Pam do? She called her anyway, knowing she was wiretapped. Shouldn't that cast doubt on what she said in those tapes? Let's recap. On June 11th, 1990, Cecilia Pierce's mother told her that the police would like to speak with her about Greg Smart's murder. Her mother brought her to the police station for an interview, and Cecilia told the police she didn't know anything about the murder. According to Cecilia, Captain Jackson said,
"If they found out that I was lying to them, he'd go next door and indict me."
According to Detective Pelletier, they were trying to let Cecilia and her mother know they were in hot water. And in his words,
he told her, "Look, you're going to be in serious trouble. You're hindering us and our investigation, so we'll charge you with it, and that's what we'll do." Her mother interjected and said, "You can't talk to my daughter like that." And Captain Jackson educated Cecilia's mother and said, "She's in deep over her head. We're trying to get her out."
We are trying to get her out. Huh? Did Pelletier just say that? Why didn't he try to get Bill, JR, and Pete out as well? That ended their interview with Cecilia and her mom, and from there, Cecilia went to Driver's Ed. Side note, I should mention in the previous episode that I said Cecilia had a learner's permit, but I misspoke. Thanks for pointing this out to me, Bill. Cecilia testified she did not have a learner's permit when she was drunkenly driving Pam and Bill around. Within days, Cecilia was hearing rumors that a girl in Seabrook was going to be arrested for helping to plan the murder of Greg Smart. So on June 14th, 1990, at around midnight, Cecilia and her mother met the Derry police at first Dunkin' Donuts and then Friendly's because Dunk's was closed. She testified that they questioned her at Friendly's for approximately 30 to 45 minutes off record before bringing her back to the Derry Police Department and recording her interview. We don't know what she told them in her interview at Friendly's. Was it a friendly meeting, you think? Too soon? Yeah, okay, moving on. After the recorded interview in Derry where Cecilia told them that Pam was involved in the planning of Greg's murder, the police had convinced her that to not be indicted for conspiring with Bill and crew, she needed to wear a wire and have her phone tapped. This is where I'll again bring up Cecilia Pierce's alleged latent fingerprint on the locking mechanism of the bulkhead door at Pam and Greg Smart's condo. You can go back to previous episodes and listen to my interaction with Bill, an online sleuth who shared this information with me, but for this episode, I want to reiterate, in no way should Cecilia Pierce's fingerprints have been on that locking mechanism of the bulkhead, if in fact they were. I have yet to verify that Cecilia's prints were on the locking mechanism. I've found reports of 25 latent prints pulled from the crime scene in the police files, but no mention of the bulkhead or Cecilia's prints. Yet. The bulkhead on a New England house is just an exterior entrance to the basement, like a storm shelter. Guests would have no reason to enter or exit through the bulkhead. If Cecilia's prints were there, it stands to reason that Cecilia, not Pam, may have let Bill and Pete into the condo. And that throws a gigantic wrench into the prosecution's theory of the case. Why are Cecilia's fingerprints important here? Because she was fingerprinted by the police when they interviewed her, and if her fingerprints were found, this would be enough to scare her into wearing a wire. It might also be enough to not put a plea deal down on paper. The detectives and AG would basically own her. This is conjecture on my part here, so take it for what you will. To me, it feels like one of those situations where the investigators had circumstantial evidence that pointed to Pam Smart, and they focused in on her while dismissing other targets. Is that why Maggiato has done so much press for the past 34 years to reaffirm his case against Pam Smart? Is that why Cecilia Pierce continues to do press? What happens if it's proven that her fingerprints were on the locking mechanism? And why has no one ever questioned that before? The fingerprints never came up in court either, so I see two possibilities. We only know about the fingerprints from Bill so far. Either it's not true that Cecilia's fingerprints are on the locking mechanism, which makes that argument dead in the water, or Maggiato knew they were there and never let the defense know. I recently asked Mark Sisti if he remembered if Cecilia's prints were on the bulkhead, and this is what he had to say.
I don't know where the hell he's getting that from.
Yeah, he said he looked at police reports or something, so I know that on one of the tapes, Cecilia says something like, you know, my fingerprints are on that thing, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't know where it's coming from.
I don't know. I have no idea.
I'm going to keep asking everyone I can about this. As of this recording, I've called every number I can find and what I know to be a good email address for Paul Maggiato and have had no luck getting through.
Has been disconnected.
Okay.
Your call cannot be completed as dialed.
Can't take your call now.
Hi there, my name is Mel Barrett. I'm hoping to get in touch with Paul Maggiato. I'm hoping this is the right number. If this is not the right number, feel free to text me and let me know. Thanks so much.
Okay, let's keep going.
The number you have dialed has been disconnected or is no longer in service.
Sweet Paul, you are a lawyer, dude. How come I can't find you anywhere?
Maggiato hasn't been in the public eye these days nearly as much as he used to be. Maybe this is why the phone numbers I keep finding for him don't work. He's only had a few blips on the radar in the past few years. One of those blips happened in 2020 when the Brooklyn Conviction Review Unit found evidence that Maggiato had misled a jury and denied the defense the opportunity to impeach a witness at a murder trial in 1989. In 2020, New York overturned a conviction Maggiato scored against Gerard DeMond for a murder a year and a half before he tried Pamela Smart for accomplice to first-degree murder in New Hampshire. On October 30th, 2020, DeMond was exonerated after spending 29 years in prison. Here's a little background from an October LMU Loyola Law School Law Review article by Lisa Griffin and Daisy Mason, entitled The Prosecutor in the Mirror, Conviction, Integrity Units, and Brady Claims. In 1989, Gerard DeMond was convicted of murder and sentenced to 25 years to life based on the death of Patrick Hinkson. Hinkson had been shot once in the head. 3 days after the shooting, one Francois Pierre walked into the 77th Precinct Police Station in Brooklyn and claimed that DeMond had shot Hinkson. Shortly thereafter, Pierre viewed a photo lineup and identified DeMond. No witnesses or DNA evidence could be found to corroborate Pierre's account, and none was presented. The state's case was rested entirely on Pierre's testimony. Before trial, Pierre entered into a cooperation agreement with the Kings County DA, whereby he would testify against Amon in exchange for a guilty plea to his pending narcotics charges with a promised sentence of 6 months jail and 5 years probation instead of a potential 5 to 15 year term of imprisonment. Pierre testified about his deal at trial. On May 30th, 1989, despite the jury's knowledge of Pierre's deal and the defense calling numerous alibi witnesses, Damon was found guilty and sentenced to 25 years to life. Damon's direct appeal and petition for a writ of habeas corpus were both denied. Throughout all proceedings, Damon maintained his innocence. In 2016, Damon's attorney sent two letters to the Brooklyn CRU asking that Damon's case be reviewed. The CRU began investigating the case and discovered that before trial, Pierre had been in custody in the Department of Corrections Psychiatric Forensic Unit at Kings County Hospital, KCH, in the G building. A takeout order, signed by trial prosecutor Paul Maggiato, was found in the trial file, alongside an undated and unsigned handwritten note that contained the phrase, quote-unquote, psychological, connected to the G building of KCH. Following this discovery, the CRU learned that the G building exclusively housed psychiatric patients and that the fact of his psychological treatment was Brady impeachment information that had never been disclosed to the defense. It also found that Maggiato actually misled the jury about the reasons for the witness's hospitalization, preventing them from evaluating the credibility of the only witness against the defendant. The CRU interviewed Maggiato by telephone on three occasions. In those conversations, he told the CRU that he knew at the time of the trial that the KCHG building was a psychiatric ward, but claimed he thought Pierre had been suffering from AIDS and surmised that he was in G building because he may have attempted suicide. There is no indication why Maggiato assumed the psychiatric commitment was related to any suicidal issue. Moreover, Pierre spent a full 4 months in the G building, and he was not simply placed on suicide watch or some other suicide prevention program. The CRU interviewed two medical experts who stated that a 4 month stay indicated a quote unquote very serious mental health condition. The experts stated that if Pierre had tried to commit suicide, he would not have been committed to the G building for so long. The Brooklyn CRU concluded that Maggiato had misled the jury and denied the defense the opportunity to impeach Pierre, regardless of whether he actually knew why Pierre was in a psychiatric ward or not. Since Pierre provided, quote, the only evidence of the defendant's guilt, unquote, the review unit recommended dismissal. So on October 30th, 2020, Damon's conviction was overturned, in effect exonerating him. There is no public record of any disciplinary action having been taken against Maggiato in New York, and I've found no other indication he was ever referred for disciplinary proceedings regarding the case. He was, however, censured by the New Hampshire Bar in 2010, according to an article by Martha Neal for the American Bar Association Journal, for having sex with a client. The irony, am I right? The article states Maggiato, quote, had a duty not to engage in a sexual relationship with his divorced client, end quote. The opinion cites an ethical rule prohibiting most sexual relationships between an attorney and a client and notes that Maggiato should have been aware as a longtime family law practitioner of, quote, the vulnerabilities of litigants in domestic cases, end quote. The woman's husband complained to authorities when he discovered the affair, saying he believed Maggiato had rushed the divorce through as a result, end quote. Maggiato refused to comment in this article because he didn't find the subject matter, quote unquote, newsworthy. So I kind of want to go on a stream of conscious rant here for a second about Maggiato and the case that happened in 1989 in Brooklyn. Maggiato knew that his key witness was in a psychiatric ward and said he assumed he was in the psychiatric ward because the guy had AIDS and he was considering committing suicide. He had actually no factual evidence of that being the case, but didn't investigate further. Pierre spent 4 months in a psychiatric unit and didn't feel the need to let the jury or the defense know about it. That's wild, right? I've also reached out to ex-Detective Sergeant Dan Pelletier, who was the lead investigator on Pam's case, but I've gotten no response. I found his Facebook and what seems like a solid phone number. I've left messages, but have not heard back. Detective Sergeant, if you're listening, I'd really love to talk to you. There's also a good deal of speculation about Cecilia having an actual deal with the state, verbal or otherwise. She was questioned by Pam's defense during the trial about why she received no charges, and it went something like this. I'll read the transcripts here because there's no video or audio of this part of Cecilia Pierce's cross-examination by Mark Sisti. Sisti, do you think you're going to be arrested for this? Cecilia, no. Sisti, why do you think you're not going to be arrested for this? Cecilia, because I asked the police if I was going to be arrested and they said no. Sisti, when did you ask the police whether you were going to be arrested? Cecilia, just the other day. A lengthy and contentious sidebar happens here, and I won't recite the whole transcript of it, but know that Mark Sisti and Paul Toomey argue to Judge Gray that a Brady Rule violation has occurred, and they request a mistrial. A Brady violation, if you're not familiar, requires prosecutors to give the defense exculpatory information or evidence, in other words, info or evidence that is favorable to the defendant, that the government is in possession of. Further, Brady material could be anything favorable to the accused, which may reduce a defendant's potential sentence, go against the credibility of an unfavorable witness, or otherwise allow a jury to infer against the defendant's guilt, according to the Legal Information Institute at Cornell. Judge Gray dismissed their motion for a mistrial and called lunch. That somehow tracks. So was Cecilia offered a deal? Did Captain Jackson tell her just days before the trial that she wouldn't be arrested? Did Paul and Diane, as Cecilia calls the prosecutors, promise that she wouldn't be arrested again during the lunch recess? You tell me. I'll read the transcripts for you again. I called Captain Jackson because there was an article in the paper saying that to avoid prosecution, I agreed to wear a body wire. And I asked him. I just called to ask who said it, and he said that nobody from the police department had said it, that he knew of, and that I was never going to be prosecuted in the first place. And later in her testimony, Sisti says, let me bring up the subject area of attempting to bring up a firearm to kill somebody. Did you go over that with Captain Jackson? Cecilia says, I don't know. Sisti, you don't know? Cecilia, I don't think so. Sisti, well, 2 days ago, 48 hours ago, do you recall going over that with Captain Jackson? Cecilia, no. Sisti, how about an hour ago? Did you go over that with the Attorney General's office? Cecilia, yeah. Sisti, who is that? Cecilia, Paul and Diane. Sisti, are you going to be prosecuted for trying to procure a firearm to kill Gregory Smart? Cecilia, no. What in the actual fuck? Let me get this straight. Under threat of indictment, Cecilia agreed to wear the wire, which Pam found out about from her lawyers. Then Pam, with a witness present, hatched a plan to trap and or get information from Cecilia on the wiretaps. Then the almost inaudible and unauthenticated wiretaps were recorded and transcribed by a quote-unquote secretary, cringe, Maggiato's word, not mine, and presented to the jury as fact. Finally, Pam was convicted while Cecilia Pierce never spent a day in juvie. Did I miss something? That's how the wiretaps as we know them came to be. In all, 5 tapes were recorded, but only 3 tapes were submitted into evidence. So what was on the other 2 tapes? The tapes that convicted Pam Smart were awful. Wiretapped conversations between Cecilia and Pam happened 4 times in 1990. June 19th, July 12th and 13th, and August 1st. Even the 3 played in court were the worst quality ever. Maggiato told the Keene Equinox, quote, we recorded it through a speakerphone to a handheld recorder. I would have done it differently, end quote. The other 2 tapes were almost entirely inaudible, so they were not presented as evidence. But on those 2 tapes, Pam Smart says she completely denied any involvement in the planning of the murder of her husband. I spoke with Pam back in 2015 of the missing tapes, and this is what she told me.
The 2 tapes that never made it into the court hearing, that the jury never heard and never were made aware of, you completely denied any involvement whatsoever when asked on tape in front of many witnesses, because I think at that point, Cecilia Pierce and her mom and 2 or 3 detectives were sitting there listening in. And in those 2 tapes, you denied it.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Those 2 tapes, denying everything. And of course, the jury never heard that.
Right.
Neither one of them. They only played the 2 tapes that they felt were incriminating.
Pam says 2 here, but really 3 tapes were played in court. This was from an interview I did with Pam nearly 10 years ago. Over the 10 years since we've been in contact, her story has always remained the same. Cecilia Pierce was the only person sharing information with her about the murder, mainly because the police had already suspected Pam. Cecilia had intimate details that she was more than willing to share with Pam. Here's another interview I did with Pam back in 2015.
The only person who had any kind of information that was giving me any kind of information about anything that happened in my house was Cecilia Pierce. The police had completely shut down, and obviously now, looking backward, that was because they had me as a suspect. But at the time, I was a widow, And that this was my husband who was murdered. And like any family member, including his mom and dad, we were all calling the police every day or speaking with the police every day to find out what was going on with the case. And what I found is that I couldn't get any information at all from them. And when I spoke to Cecilia Pierce, she was the only one that seemed to have all these details about it. Like the fact that there was a knife used on the night of the murder, that the knife was dropped and along with other items on the way outside of our condos, which proved which way the person or people who were responsible at the time exited the condo. The fact that there was supposed to have been a previous attempt on Greg's life, those were all things that I learned through conversation with Cecilia Pierce.
This case hinges on whether you believe Pam Smart. I'll reiterate that there is one witness, Brian Washburn, as well as Pam Smart's lawyers, Mark Sisti and Paul Toomey, who claim that she told them before she did it that she was going to try to entrap Cecilia. I think again of the Karen Reed case that just happened in Canton, Massachusetts. The prosecution introduced voicemails Karen left on John O'Keefe's phone minutes after she allegedly ran him over with her car and left him to die in the cold. Here's a sampling of the messages she left.
John, I'm young, you're fucking kid. Nobody knows who the fuck you are, you fucking pervert. Yeah, it's 1 in the morning, I'm with your fucking niece and nephew. You fucking pervert! You're a fucking pervert! John, I'm going home. I cannot leave you sitting here. I need to go home. You are fucking using me right now. You're fucking another girl. She's sleeping next to me. You're a fucking loser. Fuck yourself. You are a loser!
The prosecution used these messages in court to, quote-unquote, prove Karen was a crazed, drunken girlfriend who just killed her boyfriend. Is that what you'd do right after murdering someone? Would you leave hate-filled rants on the phone of someone you just killed? I'm not suggesting you'd kill anyone, seriously, don't do murder people, but does this seem plausible? To me, it suggests her innocence. She dropped him off at a party. She thinks he's cheating. He's not answering his phone, nor is he coming home. She's frantic and pissed off. So I ask you again, would someone tell her dead husband's best friend that she was going to try to entrap a witness and then under caution from her own lawyers, that specific witness, who seems to be the only one sharing intimate details about the murder of your husband, will be wired and you shouldn't speak with her? Then you go and you call that supposed wiretapped individual and confess to the murder? Does that seem plausible to you? I know I'm repeating myself here. I'm hammering the point home because the wiretaps are the only piece of evidence that was used by the prosecution to convict Pam Smart on accomplice to murder. Since they're the only evidence used against her, I want to take a moment to discuss what's on the tapes and what was in the transcripts created by the person in the AG's office who was not a certified transcriber, and this is where I want to talk about confirmation bias as well. The first tape was recorded on June 19th, 1990. It was a phone tap on Cecilia Pierce's kitchen phone. In all, three recordings happened that day. One call at 2:55 p.m., which lasted for 7 minutes and 22 seconds. Another at 3:04 p.m., which lasted 6 minutes and 25 seconds. And the last call at 3:50 p.m., which lasted for 16 minutes and 37 seconds. Here's Detective Pelletier testifying about the equipment used to record the calls.
Yeah, we brought a telephone with us. We brought two microcassette recorders and tapes to go along with that. The microphone that we were using was a suction cup that you can buy anywhere, and it plugs into the microcassette recorder, and also an earphone so that we could listen while the conversation was being taped.
Now, where does the suction cup go?
The suction cup goes on the receiver of the telephone.
It plugs into one of the microcassettes?
Right.
And that is for the purpose of picking up the conversation coming over the phone?
That's right.
And what was this earphone you were speaking about?
The earphone was plugged into the machine also, and I had it in my ear so I could listen to what the defendant was also saying while Cecilia Pierce was talking to her.
I know this seems mundane, but it's important because the recording device lends to the absolute shit-tastic quality of the audio. Remember, these guys weren't experts at one-party consent surveillance. They were just Derry, New Hampshire detectives. According to Detective Pelletier, Captain Jackson actually brought a phone from the police station to use in the recording, and when the phone sounded awful, he went out between two of the calls and borrowed a phone from the Seabrook Police Department. I'd like to think they'd want to bring in an audio expert to handle this murder investigation, but I'd be wrong. I mean, they could have gone over to the University of New Hampshire just down the road and found an audio engineer there. Even a student would have had more experience, but they didn't do that. Next, Pelletier describes how they were feeding Cecilia lines to say to Pam. This isn't out of the ordinary. It happens all the time. But what I find striking in the wiretaps and transcripts is that Pam wasn't taking the bait to incriminate herself. But then again, most of her responses on the June 19th tape are completely inaudible. Even when I enhance them myself, I can't totally make out what Pam is saying. But it seems like the assistant in the AG's office, whom no one can seem to name and who was not a certified transcriber, is able to hear Pam's responses just fine. Enough to transcribe her words. Let me show you an example. Here's a clip from the June 19th wiretap.
I doubt it. The phone people were up on and on earlier.
They were?
Yeah. I doubt it. That would be kind of stupid if not to come to my house and question me and have the phone guy out there at the same time.
You can hear Cecilia Pierce say, I doubt it. And then here's what the transcript says.
Pam, inaudible. Cecilia, the phone people were working on it earlier. Pam, they were? Inaudible. Cecilia, yeah. Pam, they were probably bugging it. Cecilia, I doubt it. That would be kind of stupid of them to come to my house and question me and have the phone guy come out there at the same time. I called Mark up and the phone disconnected me.
Are the words in the transcript what you heard? I can make out a few words here and there like, quote-unquote, probably, but that's it. I took special care to enhance a very specific few seconds of the tape, and I'm hoping my confirmation bias isn't impeding my brain here. But again, you be the judge. Here's the transcript of the portion of this tape I referenced earlier.
Cecilia, they probably all hate me for all I know with the rumors going around. Pam, inaudible. Cecilia, because supposedly my fingerprints were found on the thing and crap like that. Pam, inaudible. Cecilia, well, at least I told the guy why my fingerprints were there.
So I'm going to play the original audio and the audio I enhanced. Notice that Pam isn't totally inaudible after Cecilia says, supposedly my fingerprints were found on the thing and crap like that. Here's the original audio. And here's the audio I enhanced.
I happened to look down Cross Street. There was Ralph walking down the street. I know. They probably all hate me for all I know what the room is going on. Because supposedly my fingerprints were found on the thing and crap like that.
Feel free to play it a few times. What do you hear? I hear something along the lines of, I'm sure they found your, and that was the bulkhead? One more time, the enhanced audio. Okay, I won't belabor this any further, but it's there if you want to listen and make up your own mind. Another mishap occurred during this recording day that Pelletier details in his testimony.
As we were playing back the audio cassette from the first conversation, Captain Jackson didn't have the benefit of hearing it because he didn't have an earphone that went with it. He was listening to the first conversation. The telephone rang at around 3:04.
And what did you do at that time?
We had a second machine that was set up with a blank tape in it. We switched the microphone with the suction cup from one machine and we plugged into the second machine.
You were rewinding the first microcassette, which had the first conversation when a phone call was received at the Pierce residence.
Yeah, we were either rewinding the first or playing it back. The first wasn't ready to record. The second one was.
Okay, now did you have any trouble with the equipment at any point?
Yeah, there was a hum in the telephone line, and the telephone wasn't of the best quality either. It was a little difficult to pick up.
And what did you do when you heard this sound? Did you try and improve the method at all?
Yeah, we swapped phones. We used an additional phone. Captain Jackson went out between two phone calls and we got a telephone from the Seabrook Police Department, brought it back, and it didn't seem to help things too much. It did improve the quality somewhat.
And that was after the second phone call you did that?
Yes.
Were you able to make out and understand the conversation?
Yes.
Okay, so the second call comes in, you plug in the second microcassette. Is that correct?
That's right.
And do you hear this conversation?
Yes, I do.
Via the same method you heard the first one?
Yeah, that's correct.
And how long did this conversation take?
This was a short 4 or 5 minute conversation.
What happened after that?
Cecilia Pierce contacted Pamela Smart at her home.
And what microcassette was that third phone call put on?
After finishing the second phone call, we returned to the original microcassette recorder we had used in the original tape. So we put the second conversation, or the third conversation that we're talking about now, on the first tape. So the first and third conversations were on one tape, and the second was on a separate tape.
And what did you do after this third conversation?
We picked up our equipment, and we transported the two tapes back to the Derry Police Department.
And did you have occasion to listen to those two tapes?
Yes.
Were they a fair and accurate representation of the conversation you heard?
Yes, they were.
So I left you with Detective Pelletier's testimony about the bad equipment and the fact that they were either listening to or rewinding the first conversation when the second conversation started. They quickly switched over the recording equipment to another recorder and started recording the second conversation. But the phone was so bad, Jackson ran out and borrowed a phone from Seabrook. That phone wasn't any better, and by the time the third call happened, they'd switched back to the first recording device and recorded the third conversation on the first tape. So conversation one and three were on one tape, and conversation two was on a separate tape. These tapes were then brought back to the DPD, and Pelletier listened to them himself. Maggiato asks him, were they a fair and accurate representation of the conversation you heard? And Pelletier says, yes, they were. But how could they be? Unless Pelletier wrote down every word in the moment, or he has a photographic memory, there's literally no way to claim that these tapes are an accurate representation of the conversation Pelletier heard, because you can barely hear Pam's smart side of the conversation in these tapes. Especially, I would imagine, before they were enhanced. And there's no way these cops were listening intently to the conversation in real time while they were also futzing around with the equipment that wasn't working well. The only way to decipher this conversation is if there was a written record in the moment of the calls. Even if Pelletier heard the calls, he wouldn't be able to remember even 5 minutes later what exactly Pam Smart said, because there's no way to hear what she said. Next, Pelletier transports these tapes to Essex, Connecticut, to an audio engineer who contracts with the FBI called Bob Halversham. Bob spends hours trying to enhance the audio of the tapes. I was able to enhance it further with my editing software, and you still can't hear everything like you heard in the last segment. But a bigger question here, what was the chain of custody of the tapes? I'm reminded again of the Karen Reed trial, when Detective Proctor logged that he seized Karen Reed's SUV as evidence at 5:30 p.m., when surveillance shows he actually had the SUV in his possession 90 minutes earlier. Allegedly, Pelletier was in possession of the tapes from the time he left Cecilia Pierce's house until he returned to the Derry Police Department and listened to the tapes. Pelletier testified that the tapes were stored in an evidence locker, and 2 days later he drove the tapes from Derry to Essex, Connecticut to be enhanced. The trip from Derry to Essex is about 2.5 hours, and it took a couple of hours to enhance the tapes. So the only piece of evidence against Pam Smart, these tapes, was in Pelletier's possession for about 8 hours before dropping them off at the AG's office. So what was the chain of custody at the AG's office? And where did the quote-unquote secretary transcribe these tapes? How long did it take her to transcribe them? Did she do all of the work in the office? Was her work split between days at the office? If the tapes stayed in the AG's office while she did her work, where were the tapes kept overnight? Who had access to them? And why didn't the defense ask these questions at trial? Why didn't Sisti and or Toomey ask who transcribed the tapes and how they were transcribed in front of the jury? Why didn't Pam's attorneys ask why the transcriber's name wasn't written on the reports? And that's just the first recording. Let's get into the second recording, which happened on July 12th and was a body wire worn by Cecilia Pierce. The second recording happened because...
The original conversation on the telephone, listening to it, it seemed as if Pamela Smart was apprehensive to talk to Cecilia when Cecilia began to talk about the specific things that showed Pamela may have some involvement in the murder.
That's Pelletier testifying again. So because Pam didn't admit to Cecilia on the phone that she was guilty, the Derry police thought they'd better try again. Here's Pelletier explaining what equipment is used and how they record it.
In this case, it's a small box, about 2 by 3 inches. It's a transmitter, and it's housed inside a piece of cloth that's formed like a shoulder holster. And Cecilia Pierce wears it under her arm, and the microphone to it goes along a strap and is placed up by her shoulder. And the antenna from the unit also goes up along another strap so that it transmits over the air to a receiver. The receiver being housed inside a vehicle that's parked outside in the parking lot nearby. And the receiver has a tape recorder that's attached to it directly that records all the conversation.
Pelletier also testifies that this equipment was borrowed this time from the Salem, New Hampshire PD. Cecilia drove with her cousin Tracy, who was visiting from Missouri, in the car. Detective Pelletier drove with them for a spell as he prepped Cecilia for the interview. Then Pelletier hopped out, got picked up by an unmarked car, and along with an unmarked surveillance van, this crew made their way to the SAU 21 office where Pam Smart worked. I'd like to note that for some reason, Tracy, the cousin, remained in the car and went along for the ride. Literally. What an adventure, huh? Once at the SAU 21 parking lot, Cecilia went inside while two undercover vehicles began surveillance. The wire Cecilia wore was transmitted over the airwaves to a police scanner in the unmarked car and a recording device in the surveillance van. I guess no one was concerned with outsiders being able to listen to a witness surveilling a murder suspect. Seems a little sketch to me. Back to how they recorded this conversation. Because the first recording on the tapped phone had been such a clusterfuck, Pelletier decided he didn't want to chance anything going wrong, so he used a handheld microcassette recorder and held it up to the radio scanner to record as a backup to the surveillance van's recording. He did this for real. Cecilia entered the building at around 1 p.m. and immediately met a very anxious and fast-talking Pam. At the time, Pam Smart had seen a psychiatrist who had prescribed her anti-anxiety/antidepressant meds, and as far as Linda Wojcicki, Sonia Fortin, Brian Washburn, and Tracy Collins were concerned, the drugs were making Pam manic. You can hear the mania on this tape, though, again, you can barely hear what Cecilia Pierce and Pam Smart are saying at all. Here's a clip from the enhanced tape. You tell me. To be fair, this is probably the best recording of the four, but whew, still a mess. And the transcript doesn't match what can be heard on the tape. They also didn't have what they needed, Pam Smart confessing to planning the murder. So they went back a third time. On July 13th, 1990, the next day, Cecilia was again outfitted with the body wire and sent back to Pam Smart's office. The surveillance team was set up in very much the same fashion. One unmarked car, this time a rental, with Pelletier riding with another detective, and the surveillance van with Captain Jackson at the helm. Cecilia leaves her car, her cousin Tracy isn't with her on this day, and goes into the SAU 21 office to see Pam, who isn't there. So she stays and chats with Pam's assistant for a bit before returning to the car. Pam pulls into the parking lot, and she and Cecilia have an 18-minute or so conversation. This is the conversation that is highlighted in the trial and used against Pam Smart, though despite the DPD's best efforts, she still does not confess to planning the murder of her husband Greg. The DPD had another pretty big issue on this day as well. Here's Pelletier explaining what happened on July 13th.
We had the same setup as July 12th. I had a scanner and it was plugged into the car and I could hear the transmitter on the scanner on the radio frequency.
And was there any part of the conversation that you lost or unable to hear?
There were portions where that it was difficult to hear because there was machinery that was working in the parking lot, a big payload or a tractor, but I heard the conversation.
Did you have an opportunity to listen to the microcassette which you had used to record the conversation of Cecilia Pierce over the scanner?
Yes.
Was it fair and accurate recording of the conversation that you heard?
Yes, it is.
Did you receive the standard cassette from Michael Surrett?
Yes, I did.
Did you have occasion to listen to the standard cassette?
Yes.
And what was on that cassette?
The standard cassette didn't end up recording the conversation. There was a malfunction in the equipment, and the conversation was not recorded on that standard cassette.
So the surveillance van equipment failed. The only recording available from that day was from Pelletier's microcassette, which he was holding up to the police scanner to record. And it recorded gems like this. Pelletier then took both tapes, July 12th and 13th, out of state again to Connecticut to meet with Bob Haversham to have the tapes enhanced. The only other recording that was made after July 13th was on the day Pam Smart was arrested, August 1st, 1990. The DPD again wired Cecilia's home phone and had Cecilia call Pam Smart's office to make sure she was there so they could go arrest her. These tapes were then transcribed by a quote-unquote secretary in the AG's office. What we still don't know to this day, who was the secretary and why weren't these transcripts certified? I spoke with Ben Walker of Ditto, a transcription company located in Colorado, about how this whole process should work. Ben worked with me on short notice to jump on the phone to discuss, and here's what I found.
Law enforcement agencies we work with, they want us, like I said before, want us to certify it. If they don't, they're normally going to copy-paste it into their record management system, and then the officer signs off on it. So he's signing it that it is true and accurate instead of us. So it all depends, like I said, how they're going to use it. If they want to give it to the DA for prosecution,
yeah,
they're going to have us certify it all day long because they don't want the officer to have to get on the stand and say, oh, I read all this. It's all accurate. Those types of transcripts you're talking about,
yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the way it was done back then, unfortunately.
Right.
Like, they didn't have companies like us to use as a third party, uninterested, you know, unbiased.
Right.
And now they do, so they take advantage of it.
Ben was super helpful and even went a step further. He offered to transcribe the audio recordings for me, so I could compare what a certified transcriber would have transcribed as opposed to a biased, unnamed individual who worked for the AG's office. I spoke with Pam's new lawyer, Matt Zernhelt, again, and he agreed it would be useful. So the new and improved transcripts won't make it into this episode, sorry, but expect a bonus episode covering them. I'm so interested to see what we find out. After a quick break, I'm going to take you through the rabbit hole of notes, 8 handwritten pages in all, that I made myself, showing instances where the transcripts didn't match the tapes. Hold on to your butts.
Inaudible PS does not say, how would they find out? PS does not say, who would know? She steps on her words and says, who would say that? Only. Who would say that? CP most definitely does not say JR's name here. She also does not say, what I know. She says, what I am. This TR is completely wrong. Even if he did know that, inaudible. P.S. does not say, it's his word against yours. Then crosstalk, but it sounds like P.S. says, they can't prove you killed someone. P.S. says, well, if you knew about it beforehand. Not, well, if you didn't know. Crosstalk starts at, you say you knew about it beforehand. There's no way to decipher that P.S. then says, you're going to be in trouble, as the T.R. states. T.R. makes a big stretch to get to P.S. saying, I know, I really... TR makes a big stretch to get to PS saying, we can't talk about shit that should have happened. I hear PS say, shit that happened. There's no way she repeats, should have happened though, you know, after inaudible. It sounds like PS is saying, shouldn't have happened.
These are my notes on just the July 13th wiretap. I have 8 handwritten pages of inconsistencies between the wiretaps and transcripts on just this one recording that were used to convict Pam Smart. My point in all this, a random person working in the Attorney General's office, who can't be named by the prosecutor, was used to create transcripts of nearly inaudible wiretaps that were heavily biased in favor of the prosecution. The transcripts were never certified. The lead detective testified that upon listening to the inaudible tapes that he concluded they were a fair and accurate representation of the conversation he'd heard. And then the DA, Paul Maggiato, blew these transcripts up on giant whiteboards and sold them to the jury as fact and a confession from Pam Smart. Here's Maggiato in his closing argument with the big whiteboards of the transcripts standing in front of the jury, selling the story to them. I'll note here that the words he's using on the boards don't match what's on the tape, and it's a pretty distinct error. I noted it in note 6, which you just heard a couple minutes ago. Hear for yourself.
Remember that time you let Bill use your car to go up there? Where? Up to your house? Yeah. Well, that time, if they hadn't forgotten directions, he could have killed Greg then. I know. I really. I wouldn't have even had spent the next week with you. I know, but it's history now, because, you know, we can't talk about S-H-I-T that should have happened. What does it tell you, ladies and gentlemen? She's not just saying to Cecilia Pierce, I knew about the murder beforehand. They're corroborating with Bill Flynn Kelsey that there was a prior plan that they all knew about. She's admitting it right here. This isn't some woman who's just throwing out comments.
and neither Toomey or Sisti objected. So let's back up briefly before we move on. A suppression hearing happened before the trial began because the defense wanted to restrict the tapes from being entered as evidence. Their argument? The wiretaps shouldn't have been admitted because Pam Smart had legal representation at the point the recordings happened. So her constitutional rights were violated and that Cecilia Pierce was a minor at the time and could not give her actual consent. That's it. That's Sisti and Toomey's argument. Not that the transcripts are inconsistent and don't match. Not that the tapes haven't truly been authenticated, other than testimony from Detective Pelletier saying he was there and they represent what he heard. Not that the jury would have the transcripts as a guide to follow along when they couldn't hear the tapes themselves. Do I need to remind you that their 22-year-old client was on trial for accomplice to first-degree murder and was up for life with no parole? I wish I could have reminded them. Close your eyes and remember yourself at 22 years old for a moment. Now imagine you've been accused of planning your spouse's murder. You know and swear you had nothing to do with it. You've never confessed. You've turned down a plea deal because you know you can prove yourself not guilty in court at your trial. You were trying desperately to gain information about the murder of your husband, who was killed by the 16-year-old you'd had an inappropriate sexual relationship with. And now you're sitting in court and reading transcripts that say words you never said, and your attorneys are telling you they can't fight it unless your parents come up with another $25,000 to hire an expert. You can't come up with the money, so your lawyers don't touch the tapes or the transcripts in your defense. You lose. You spend the rest of your life in prison with literally no option for parole and no chance to get out. You die slowly while living behind bars because two people you trusted, Mark Sisti and Paul Toomey, didn't do their jobs. Okay, you can open your eyes now, if you want. Here's Mark Sisti talking about how he feels about the tapes.
Well, first of all, none of the transcripts were admitted as evidence.
Okay.
In fact, the only evidence that would be placed before the jury would be the recordings. So they would have to determine whether or not that which was said in the recordings was accurate, that which was said in the recordings had any relevance whatsoever. I'm not going to sit back here and say that it was overwhelming evidence, but it was certainly sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction. The tapes that did come in, mm-hmm. I'll be quite frank, were damning. They were not good, all right? And they, unfortunately, were the words coming out of my client's mouth. And they weren't subtle, they weren't kind. And they certainly were not words that would exonerate her.
The words on the tapes may have been damning.
Don't tell him that you knew, and all you have to say is, well, Joe told Pete the wrong thing, and if Joe's a murderer, he's obviously a liar. So, you know, what the hell? That's just it. I mean, they're not going to believe Joe and Pete on the witness stand against you. I mean, come on, they're on trial for murder, you know? I mean, they're not going to be believing you and them. All they want to know is there anybody else that knew about this before it happened? Because if there is, then they can really bag them, you know? But that's the thing. So I don't know, you know, I mean, I wish this wasn't the circumstances. You know, I hate the fact that you have to be interviewed. I hate the fact that you're scared. I hate the fact that you're probably going to have to take a lie detector test. But I don't know what to tell you. If you told the truth, it was going to do you any good, that'd be one thing. But it's not. If you tell the truth, I mean, you cannot change what you know, you know? And if you tell the fucking truth, you are probably going to be arrested. And if you're not arrested, you're going to have to go and you're going to have to send Bill, you're going to have to send me, you're going to have to send JR, you're going to have to send me to the fucking slammer for the rest of our entire life. And unfortunately, that's the situation you're in. And not only that, but your parents are going to be like, fucking Cecilia, you know, what the hell? I mean, I think your parents will get over the fact.
I'm going to cut the audio here because it sounds like a train drives right through the middle of Cecilia and Pam, but you get the gist. So again, the tapes, damning for sure. Another point, why was it not hammered home to the jury that according to Greg's best friend, that supposedly was her actual intention? The prosecution had Cecilia Pierce testifying about what Pam was saying on the tapes, but the defense had Brian Washburn saying that Pam told him her plan to entrap Cecilia. Why did the defense not drill this into the jury? Did Pam's type A personality, that sort of, you're not doing your job, so I'll just do it for you mentality, do her in? It probably would have done me in. I was raised by a woman who just did it herself because everyone else was incapable of doing it right. I became that person. It served me well, and then it didn't. Pam, by all accounts, was a go-getter, an overachiever. She wanted to be something in the world. It's what drove her to do interviews with local reporter Bill Spencer right after the murder. She wanted Bill's job, so she tried to produce his segments for him. She needed to tell the story, at least at the time what she wanted told of the story. The inappropriate sexual relationship with Bill was the biggest secret she was holding, and she couldn't allow it to get out because it would tarnish that perfect facade she'd built in the 22 years she'd been on the planet. But a lot of people believe she was trying to direct the narrative so that the authorities wouldn't look at Bill. Many New Hampshireites believe, to this day, she was a media-hungry slag who was trying to get everyone to look the other way because she conspired to have her husband murdered. But what if the whole thing was just FDPS, that syndrome I mentioned at the beginning of the episode? Candid Camera had been out for years, and MTV's The Real World was just about to come out. In my opinion, Pam was acting for the cameras in every aspect of her life. She couldn't let anyone know the reality of her existence. She was unhappy in what appeared to be the perfect relationship, though there were signs of abuse those closest to her ignored. Her new husband had just cheated on her. She wanted desperately to be a newscaster, but instead she was working as a media services coordinator for a local school district in New Hampshire. She wasn't in sunny, hip, and happen in Florida anymore. She wasn't a local celebrity, the mistress of metal. She was living in a part of New Hampshire that was hard, working class, dreary. Sometimes she was scared, barely more than a kid herself, not in control, not sure who she was in the world, and wanting to explore her own power and sexuality. And then her husband was murdered. No one could know what her real life was like. It would embarrass her. It would embarrass her family. She would be blamed. And she was. She still is. And for someone who was supposedly the genius mastermind of this planned murder, she sure didn't take the time to plan for after Greg was killed. If she planned this, she left her life and future in the hands of a group of teenagers who couldn't stop talking about what they'd done. Doesn't sound very mastermindy to me. What do you think? There's more to come on the wiretaps, but that'll be in bonus episodes. For now, I'll leave you with Karen Sakar, Juror 13's take on the wiretaps from her recorded diary after trial every day. This is a reenactment, but she's succinct in her opinion.
The tapes felt contradicting. It sounded, you know, incriminating. But if you believe her story, that would explain the tapes. I'm not saying I believe it, but it's a possibility. Pam doesn't have to prove she's innocent. The state has to prove she's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and that creates a big doubt on the one piece of evidence that would get her. Somewhere lies the truth, and we're never going to know really what it is. Tough call. You are innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Back when I planned out my episodes and I was putting the story in chronological order, I had planned to cover the trials and errors in episode 6. It was a good plan. Until an avalanche of information about the case fell into my lap, and I finally found prosecutor Paul Maggiato in late September of 2024. I spoke with Maggiato at length, and I feel it's important to take a deep dive on my interview with him next, before I dissect the trial. I've been wanting to hear his side of things for a long time, and there's a lot to unpack there. I think you'll find our conversation enlightening. So that's next on The In-Between, me and Maggiato, trying not to talk over one another. Here's a preview of my conversation with prosecutor Paul Maggiato.
So you're doing 4 hours on Pam's mouth.
I am. There's a lot. I could do a lot more, actually.
Personally, what I said in my summation was, if you believed Bill Flynn, that's all you needed.
Cecilia Pierce's prints were included. A 6-point identifier was found of Cecilia Pierce's prints on the bulkhead. Do you know anything about that?
I guess the reason I'm interrupting you, I think sometimes the media does a disservice when they try and raise questions and try and make a mountain what I suggest is at best a molehill. Go ahead and do what you gotta do.
You're also giving me a prosecutor's answer, though, because my job is to figure out if there are any holes and if I can tell that story too. You know what I mean? I understand that you don't want me to ask questions that are unfounded in fact, but I still have to ask the questions if they pop up and it seems like information that should be in the file.
You're don't misunderstand me. Okay. I'm not saying you can't ask questions. I don't want you to ask questions implying there's a factual basis to support them. Not saying that.
Well, because I'm going to be honest with you, Paul, I don't think she believes. I think she believes she's innocent.
I think she's convinced herself so she can convince her supporters. So you acknowledge that this whole business then of accepting responsibility is BS. She's not accepting responsibility. She's accepting responsibility for an affair. That's it.
She is accepting, that's the differentiation. I think she accepts responsibility for the affair. She accepts responsibility for the fact that her relationship led to her husband's death, but she refuses to take any responsibility for the planning of the murder. And as adamant as she is, I have to give it some credit.
That was her testimony. That was her testimony at trial.
The In-Between is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett. I also do some of the audio editing, but I couldn't content edit this sucker without the amazing Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Amber Hunt, my editor. Amber keeps me on track and helps cut the bullshit. Thanks, Amber. Thanks as well to my research partner and cousin-in-law, Lacey Umble. I also couldn't get this done without the kick-ass team at Grabbag Collab, Amber Hunt, Amanda Rossman, and Daisy Egan. The In-Between wouldn't exist without the encouragement and support of my dear friend, fellow podcaster, and all-around rock star, Yellen Marie Marsh. I love you, Ellen. Thanks for all you do. And I want to send another shout-out to Rebecca Lavoie over at Crime Writers On, who gave me my first feedback on the series and encouraged me to pitch it. Thanks, Rebecca. Finally, my love, my partner, Lindsay, your support and belief in me always keeps me moving forward, even when the way ahead is very dark. Thanks for doing this with me. Also, your reenactments are my favorite. If you want to dive deeper into the cases I cover, visit inbetweenpod.com for source material and updates. You can find all the episodes and bonus content of The In-Between on the Grabbag Collab main Patreon feed. Until the next time, be good people and don't do murder.